listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And obviously, I am not Monica or Caroline. This is Steve Cooperman filling in for Monica and Caroline today as your guest hosts for today, Friday, November 28th, if you're listening to our live broadcast, or Monday, December 1st, if you are listening to our rebroadcast. Our guest today is Gregory Paul Johnson, author of Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Greg.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
So it would be a good place to start to just give a little bit of a background about what the book is about.
Well, it's in some respects just the story of my 5 years living in a tiny home, a 10-by-7 house in the Iowa City area. So it's part just relating that story, but it's also a holistic look, a step back, looking holistically at living simple and living small and how that impacts transportation and food and relationships and other areas of life.
And so what inspired you to have that change in your lifestyle?
Well, I began a number of years back looking at how to live more effectively, more efficiently, and I saw that simple living was one way to do that, certainly to save money, but also to save time and redirect energy and finances toward other causes and other issues I was passionate about.
So how long have you lived in this 140-square-foot home?
Since the fall of 2003. It was built in the summer of 2003.
Uh-huh. So. And that's in Iowa City.
Yep.
And why don't you tell a little bit about the background? It's in the book, we're talking about how you... the particular home that you built in the connection with Jay Schaefer. And
maybe just to back out a little bit more and give the big picture is my website, resourcesforlife.com, talks about effective living through balancing the different areas of our life. And the point of the website is to empower activists. I see activists as being what white blood cells are to the body, activists are to humanity. You know, they're out there kind of cleaning things up, the environment, politics, consumer issues. So activists are good. We don't have enough of them, probably. So the idea is that if we can make activists more effective, then essentially it's like having a better immune system for humanity.
So that website was created before you wrote the book or after you wrote the book?
Before I wrote the book.
So you had already had this website, Resources for Life.
Yes.
And then, so then how did that...
So I began looking for myself and others for ways to be having a greater impact. You know, certainly mm-hmm. when you're working on an initiative for more bicycle paths or, you know, clean air, whatever the issue is, you're passionate about it, you want to get the most out of it. And... I think our inclination is to just pour ourselves into, so we just went through the political campaigning, you know, of this last fall, and people tend to put a lot of things on the back burner. You know, you don't go to the gym because, you know, if going to the gym or going to knock on doors makes the difference between, you know, a positive future or a negative one, you're going to skip the gym.
Uh-huh.
So my point is that we need to live holistically and balanced and get the daily exercise in, take that time, you know, to meditate and do yoga in the morning and exercise and eat well. There's just a lot of areas of life that need to be in balance, and then we'll be most effective. So with that larger picture in mind of just kind of a holistic living, the website, resourcesforlife.com, I began looking at, rather than another one of these books of, you know, 1,001 things you can do to save the planet, you know, who has time to do 1,001 things. What are like 5 things? You know, uh-huh. what are like a few things that people can do? And you'll see the connection here in a minute. But let me talk about bicycle riding, for example. You know, when you ride a bicycle in a town like Fairfield or Iowa City or Berkeley or Madison, or you know, there are lots of towns that have this new urbanism approach, which is really like, you know, designing a town for the 1800s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea is that you're living close to where the grocery store is, which is close to the library, close to your work, close to your home. Everything's within sort of 5 or 10 blocks. And when you have little pods of communities and cities like this, it means that bicycling is possible. So you choose to ride a bike. That means you're saving time, you're saving money, you're getting exercise, there's less noise pollution, there's less air pollution. You know, there's just this multiplicity of benefits from it. So making the jump now to small house living, I found the same thing is true. It's this one, you know, simple life change you can make live in a smaller space, suddenly it impacts your finances, your health, your relationships, the, you know, environment. It's like, it's one of those kind of no-brainer simple things that anyone can do and suddenly have an amazing impact on their life and their community.
Well, and I will say, speaking from my own personal experience, I made a decision about a year ago to move into a smaller space. It's about, it makes your space, makes your, my space seems gigantic compared to yours. It's about 500 square feet right near the square. And I've had that experience since living in that house. I walk a lot, almost all everywhere. And just that simplifying is, something on the inside has changed, and so I can relate to that experience. So what kind of space were you living in before you moved into the 140 square foot home?
Well, about 2,000 square feet. So it was a big change. I initially I was in a relationship that didn't work out, and so she went her way and I went my way, and I reevaluated what my needs were and realized I didn't need 2,000 square feet. At least I didn't personally need that. What I realized is I could outsource a lot of space. So I still probably use 2,000 square feet, but I only, you know, have under my own responsibility a 10 by 7 space.
Yeah, so you talk about this in your book, both the concept of outsourcing and this concept of having actually 2,000 square feet. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so in transitioning to the, let's say, 140 square feet, I was able to, you know, use an office at the place where I work is the University of Iowa. I'm there most of the time. My actual consulting work that I do outside of my regular job doesn't really need a storefront. I'm going to businesses or homes to do computer work. So I was able to, you know, go to the gym, use these other resources, meet at a coffee shop if I need to meet with somebody. And it meant that, you know, I could have this much smaller home. Another factor I think that people can relate to is the role of technology, how technology is shrinking our lives. So I still have, you know, my movie collection and my music CDs, and I still have, you know, all my banking statements and all of these things that used to be sort of in a physical format and require, you know, bookshelves and filing cabinets. I haven't done without. It's just all those things now fit inside of a notebook computer because we're living more and more in an information age that's shrinking.
So talk about what your house has and what it doesn't have.
Okay. And just to go back, you know, I like to let people know I'm still using 2,000 square feet. I still, in a way, I rely on electricity because I charge up my notebook computer or my cell phone when I'm not at home. But what my house has and doesn't have, it doesn't have electricity. It doesn't have running water. It doesn't have a bathroom. And so I guess this is like the person who says they're vegetarian and a meat eater says, well, then what do you eat? You know, well, what's left if
right.
those things aren't
right.
there? But no, I had been renting for a couple of years an efficiency apartment, and it was adequate. It was fine. And the efficiency apartment was a 10 by 12 room. I was sharing a bathroom with some other people in the home. And so really it's a freestanding efficiency apartment. And rather than trying to build a bathroom into it, I realized, you know, this is going to be sitting somewhere, either in a small community, a cottage community of little cottages and cabins, or I'll have the house next to a larger house where if I need to, I can use the shower and restroom there. So it's really just it's a bedroom. There's a space where I can study. There's a desk and an office area essentially in there. A small kitchenette like you might find in a little camper. And certainly small homes can have, you know, bathrooms and showers and other amenities. But I really wanted to be off the grid. I wanted to know if we were to lose access to electricity, for example, you know, in the winter we get these ice storms and you hear about stories of 100,000 people without electricity for, you know, like 5 days. I didn't want my heat dependent upon some furnace having electricity to operate, you know. So my heating system is just all... it's radiant heat from an LP gas boat heater, actually. So the house doesn't have electricity, doesn't have running water. Part of the reason for going this route was just some life experiences that I had. My family, we used to go visit some friends of ours in the Kelowna, some Amish people. And I was fascinated by how these people had, like, you know, horses pulling buggies, which is like this organic powered transportation thing, you know,
right, right.
that you just feed it grass. So it's like a car that runs on grain, you know, and their homes didn't have electricity and they seemed to live just fine. So I guess I developed sort of a romanticized view of what it would be like to live without electricity, and I wanted that to be part of my home.
So, and what would you say have been the benefits for you personally versus what you feel like you may have given up in choosing this lifestyle?
Well, the benefit is it's very freeing to kind of release yourself of a lot of troubles and worries, you know. A much less complicated house, it has less upkeep. I mean, there's basically zero maintenance in this home.
Right.
And zero worries. It's not like, oh, gee, nothing's broken yet. You know, I mean, there's nothing to break. There's nothing that's going to, the pipes aren't going to freeze because there are no pipes, you know. And there's something really freeing about that. As I look back on my life in times, my dad and brother and I, we would go to the mountains of West Virginia as a retreat. We'd go to this cabin up there, and because it's in the middle of the mountains, there was no running water, no electricity. There was a spring. We would go get water using buckets from this spring, carry them up the hill,
uh-huh.
pour the water in a little reservoir above the kitchen sink, and that was the water supply. I love that. You know, I mean, that's vacation. And I think for a lot of people, that's what they envision. When you say the word vacation, then they picture being in some little cabin or retreat somewhere, and the birds are singing, and there's no electricity. And
uh-huh, uh-huh.
So why not live like you're on vacation, you know, every day?
Right,
it's totally
right.
possible.
Well, and one of the things you talk about in your book is about how simplifying your life reduces, it gives you more, it frees up your time because you don't have to spend as much time earning a living, earning income.
Right, right.
Talk a little bit about that in terms of how it's impacted your life.
Well, I found when I was living in the 2,000 square foot home, it was sort of the dream home, but then the dream home typically requires like working two jobs, you know, to pay the mortgage for it. And of course, in today's housing crisis, you know, we don't really know what the value of homes will be. They kind of fluctuate. So it's not necessarily a guaranteed investment. And by reducing those expenses, the heating expense, the electrical expense, all of the water bill, the gas bill, all of that, it's given me more time to enjoy life. And over the years, as I've had a chance to meet some people who were basically independently wealthy, you know, millionaires or billionaires, one thing I noticed about their lives was that their lives were very simple. They didn't have a lot of material stuff. It's like they weren't trying to prove that they were successful anymore, you know? And so it was really the people who had all the material things who were trying to make some point about how wealthy they were the ones that really weren't wealthy, the ones that were in debt and paying off credit cards and, you know, making multiple car payments. And it's these people I know that are really wealthy. You go into their homes, they don't have, they have very few possessions because they realize, they make the connection, you know, material things are not a good investment, you know, like furniture and little knickknacks and,
huh.
you know, the investments would be business or education or something that's going to pay back a return.
So you're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU LP 100.1 FM. I'm your host, Steve Cooperman, filling in for Monica and Caroline. And we're talking today to Gregory Paul Johnson, author of Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. So one of the things that the thought comes into one's mind, and you talk about this in the book, that it seems like this kind of lifestyle would be easier for single people, but then maybe more difficult for married couples or families. So how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one of the aspects to small living is it's not just the mechanics and architecture of, you know, how do you design a small space? There's a lot of internal work that needs to be done. You know, a person needs to be content with less stuff. A person needs to be kind of self-confident about who they are and not having a sense like they need to prove something. So, you know, to ride a bicycle as your only mode of transportation and live in a little 10-by-7 house, you know, a person really needs to be at a point in their life where they say, look, I don't need to prove anything to anybody. I'm just going to enjoy
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm at home, you know, drawing my sense of satisfaction, my sense of self-worth, my sense of contentment and happiness from something other than, you know, having lots of material things around me. So I made reference to, you know, meditation, exercise, just relationships. I enjoy writing. I enjoy reading what's on the internet and listening to music. So there are a lot of I guess I'm plugged into a lot of information and technology-based satisfaction and gratification sources.
You know? So do you see a way for married couples or families to live in this kind of a setup?
Yeah, I think so. You know, part of the what appears to be a magic trick of me living in this 10x7 house is that I am only one person. So as soon as you have a family of four, you need to do the math and multiply, you know, 140 square feet times four or maybe more. And certainly kids have a little bit higher energy and need for their own space for playing and that type of thing. So, yeah, the dynamics of the household would determine the size of the house. And also, you know, I have the luxury, I guess, of being in the information industry. So my computer work, my writing, the things that I do as my vocation for an income, for livelihood, can all be done out of this little notebook that I have here that's, you know, like less than an inch high.
Right.
It's about the size of a notebook. So anyway, I think that that's something we need to be mindful of as well, is that people that maybe want to have pottery that they're doing at home, or need an artist workshop or something like that, or they do woodwork. You know, there are people that do need more space because of their vocation.
Sure. And one of the concepts that you talk about in the book, and that's particularly of interest to me, is the concept of community, of creating community, and that ideally what you're talking about is having many of these smaller homes where people are living, and then shared community space where some of this other stuff can happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's really where all this gets exciting. You know, one person living in a small space, that's neat, it's fun. I like the fact that I could choose, you know, higher grade materials because it's a smaller home. But other than that, you know, it's just somebody living in a small freestanding space. I'm a homeowner instead of a renter, that's nice. When you start talking about communities, though, and small houses, the benefit is you get the advantages of living in like a cooperative living situation. So there are other people around. You get the social benefits. But you also have a retreat you can go to. I mean, you do have your own house.
Right.
Let's use the number 10 just for simple math. Let's say, you know, 10 people get together. They have 10 tiny homes in a little village that they create. They could have one larger community center where there's a big kitchen, a big dining area, maybe even a fitness center, showers. If that stuff can be centralized, laundry, suddenly you really don't need plumbing in a house or maybe electricity. And that really does lower the cost of a house. I mean, it makes a huge difference. So if I had to tie my house into the city sewer and the city electric and the water and all of that, it would just be cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just wouldn't be worth it. Uh-huh. So by being able to get by without having those things, there's a big advantage to that. So getting back to this community idea, when there's a community, let's say the people in the community decide, hey, we'd really like to get one of those nice electric lawnmowers that you can charge up, but gee, they're a lot of money. Well, you know, suddenly everything's 90% off.
Right.
You know, you chip in your 10%, everybody chips in 10%. So your economy, it's like you're living in the U.S., but your money stretches as if you're like living in Mexico somewhere.
And for me, what hits me is in terms of putting families together, when you have a shared space, the issue of not enough space for the kids in a living situation goes away, because then they can go to this other space, then they have other kids to interact with. There's probably outdoor space, so they're not trapped to the size of the house.
Yeah, and even the playground area, you know, that can be shared. Even some of the, you know, if there are enough families coming together, you could have your own daycare.
So is there any place that you know of that they're doing something like this?
Well, there's some places that are having these intentional communities. You know, I have a list on the website. If you go to smallhousesociety.org, that'll take you to resourcesforlife.com. But you'll see the Small House Society website has a page with resources. And if you go to the resources page, you'll see communities. And on the communities page, there are a number of examples. Well, in fact, I have, there's one in a place called Fairfield, Iowa,
right.
Abundance Eco Village. There's something called the Tofty Project, North Shore of Lake Superior, Michigan, an eco village that's the home of the Wild Goose Bed and Breakfast in New York. But there are a number of these little villages, cottage communities in Washington, and I have those listed as well.
So, and how much of this has come about because of the work of Jay Schaefer? And you mentioned in your book that it was an article about him in the Des Moines Register that introduced you to his homes, the tumbleweed houses, which ironically is how I got interested in all this. Somebody told me about, hey, go check out this website, and I looked at it because for some reason I was attracted to the same concept.
Yeah, I saw this front page article about Jay in the Des Moines Register. My recollection is it was front page. And anyway, I contacted the Register and asked them if I could put that on my website. And they said that would be fine. Within a year, I started getting phone calls and emails from people who were expressing an interest in smaller living. And they sort of like panicked. They were like, I've got to get in touch with Jay. Where can I find Jay? You know? Uh-huh. So I thought, well, I need to find out where he's at and, you know, get his phone number and email so I can be forwarding uh-huh. these requests. Uh-huh. And I sensed that there was this growing movement, you know, we're catching on here in the U.S. to this small house, what we're calling the small house movement, which has been going on in the rest of the world for, you know, 5,000 years.
Right.
We're, you know, 5% of the population of the planet consuming like 25 to 35% of the resources, depending on what you're looking at. So we're realizing, oh, gee, you know, if everybody on the planet were to live the way we do, we'd be needing 500% of what the world can produce. So the way we're living isn't going to work. It just isn't. It can't, you know. We can't export this lifestyle, and it's not fair to maintain it here. So so there's this movement towards simpler and smaller living here in the U.S., kind of a rebirth. But we're in this weird time right now when small houses are still illegal in many communities. I mean, the city...
Oh, really?
Yeah. And of course, the realtors, they don't have any interest in selling a $10,000 house. You know, you get your commission on the sales. So they're trying to sort of outlaw... low commission homes, you know. Uh-huh. Cities fear that small houses mean, you know, poor people. So I guess they want to discriminate against letting poor people live somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And so small houses are illegal unless they're like grandfathered in. I mean, certainly just right nearby, Herbert Hoover, the Herbert Hoover home uh-huh. is a small house. You know, I mean, that's the house he grew up in.
Uh-huh.
It's a one room house. And, so there are these examples of small homes that have been here in the U.S. that were pretty typical, and we've moved away from that, and now there are people wanting to move back to that, and they're really having trouble fighting the legislation that has in place, you know, these minimum size standards, which is a real irony because here, you know, I went to the city and I asked them about my home, and they said, no, I'm sorry, it's, you know, it's illegal to have a living space that's smaller than, you know, 120 square feet. And I said, but wait a minute, you know, how is it? No, it was 1,200 square feet. That's what it was. I don't know. They have some outrageous law. See?
Wow.
And anyway, what I realized is, so the city permits landlords to rent out tiny apartments to people, mm-hmm. but the city prohibits somebody from becoming a homeowner of a tiny house, the size of a tiny apartment that they might be renting.
Right.
So really what it's doing is it's institutionalizing poverty. It's preventing the free flow of what I like to call distributed capitalism, you know, where you know, I'm all for capitalism, but let's spread the wealth around so everyone can be a capitalist, right? You know,
right.
I mean, what we're doing is we're preventing capitalism because we're saying, no, we don't want people to be homeowners. We want them to be enslaved into paying rent the rest of their life, enriching somebody else's net worth and equity. So that's what the struggle is for, is let people live simple, let people live small, let people build these small homes. Don't make it illegal as long as they're safe and sanitary.
So you saw this article, it was like, I think it said in the book 2001,
yeah.
And it was 2 years later that you bought and moved into your own house.
Right.
Now, was this mm-hmm. built here in Iowa, or did you drive it out from wherever?
Well, at the time, Jay was in Iowa City.
Oh, he was?
Yeah. His background is in sort of art and architecture and then kind of sacred geometries. He draws from a really diverse background of information when he puts these homes together, and mine was kind of a prototype. It was the first one other than his own that
really?
Built. Yeah.
Oh, so it was really the genesis of his company that's doing this, huh?
And to my knowledge, was kind of the first pseudo-commercially built small home,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, yeah, it was between 2000 and 2001 was this article in the Des Moines Register. Then in 2001 in the fall, Jay and I and Shay Salomon and Nigel Valdez started the Small House Society. And then after, you know, 2002 rolled by, and then we went into 2003, and I sort of felt... embarrassed about being, you know, the head of this small house society and not really living in a small house, you know. And I wanted to live in a small house. So I went to Jay and I said, well, let's do this. Let's build this small house for me. And he was very generous with his time, and, you know, the materials were about $15,000. And so, you know, I what would have otherwise been an expense of like $300,000 for me ended up being, you know, the price of a used car.
So, and at what point did you decide to write a book about your experience?
Well, that came much later. I really enjoy writing, as, you know, as people would be able to tell from visiting the website and seeing some of my newsletters. I enjoy writing, but I had not planned on writing a book. Then after really Jay was, I think, responsible for getting so much initial media attention with National Public Radio and the Oprah Winfrey Show. I mean, he really helped the small home movement become mainstream.
Huh.
You know, I mean, when you get Oprah sitting there saying, wow, I really like your house, this is great, you know?
Oh, really? So they visited his house and...
Yeah, they did a video and had him on the show.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Yeah, I went to the Chicago for the, you know, recording of the show.
Uh-huh,
it was fun.
Uh-huh.
I kind of got off track there, but where were we?
We were talking about how you got into
writing the book. Yeah. So there was this interview with Cheryl Corley out of Chicago, National Public Radio, and that was the first kind of national media exposure that the small house movement got. And during the course of that interview, you know, I was on that show, and then I noticed, you know, 70,000 hits on my website within 24 hours, you know.
Wow.
So that really made me realize that, you know, this is not like click here and then go to, I mean, they had to listen to that on the radio, and then, I don't know, when they got home at night, go to the web. I mean, there was sufficient interest to get people to actually go from their radio to a computer and get online and find out more about this small house movement. And subsequently, there have been other, you know, one day there were 50,000 hits when a blip just for 30 seconds appeared on AOL's website about small houses.
Wow.
And suddenly, yeah. So there's a real hunger out there for this movement, which is exciting.
But so then what?
Oh, and the book. Okay, yes, you're good. You're good.
Yeah.
I'm like a politician here.
That's all right.
You know, that's a good question. I want to talk about that book.
Right.
You know, the economy is.
Yeah. You don't want to talk about your book. Wait a minute. Yeah, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah. So there was this interview and more media attention. And I got contacted out of the blue by this publisher, Gibbs Smith, out of Utah. And as I understand it, there's some listeners out in Utah today, in North Carolina.
Yeah,
yeah, I was told that there would be.
I think we have more listeners outside of Fairfield than we do inside Fairfield.
Okay.
There's lots of people listening all over the world.
Oh, that's great. So this publisher contacted me and asked me if I had ever thought about writing a book. And we got into a telephone discussion about it and began working on an outline. And I was just really excited about the idea of pursuing that. I know how difficult it is to actually have a book and try to get it published. So to me, there was sort of a story it being born right then, the whole idea of, you know, a publisher contacting a writer and saying,
that's a very
write a book.
That's not how it usually goes.
Actually, that was kind of the impetus, was just like, this is so cool, I've got to write a book just to tell the story about how I wrote the book.
So how did they find out about you? I know that they have their slogan is that they're enriching and inspiring humankind. So they obviously have an orientation towards this kind of subject matter.
Yeah, it was later I realized, kind of after being in the process of writing the book, I'd gone to their website and I saw some of the other books that they've published, and they're books that I already knew about, that I liked,
nice,
that I admired, and I didn't realize that they were the source, the publisher of these books. So it was a good fit. You know, they do try to have meaningful and purposeful publications, and they seek those out. They really do. So it's not.
Yeah,
just
they have
like,
an interesting story. I know I was looking up online and that they converted a barn into their workplace, and now they're quite a bit. They're pretty large. I mean, they're not huge, but they're a good size. It's not just a one or two person operation.
Right, right.
And so, at what point did they contact you? How long ago?
So that would have been in 2006. I'm pretty sure that's when it was. And we started working on the book back then. I had, you know, experiences and material to draw from. And ultimately, the book took shape into, you know, being chapters about different areas of life.
And before we continue, I just want to repeat that you're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU LP 100.1 FM. I'm Steve Cooperman, filling in for Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Gregory Paul Johnson, author of Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. So how long did it take you to write the book from the time you started?
Ultimately it was a year and a half or two, working on pulling a lot of the material together that I already had and polishing it more and more. It was really a special thing for me. I just guess from the whole process of it wasn't just your typical manufacturing robotically some new textbook and then finding somebody to market it for you and then commercially selling it. It was really organic. And the book itself, I wanted to incorporate some practices that I thought were just in general good practices to promote through, publishing. You'll find blank pages in the book. And that was important to me. At the end of each chapter, I have action points, discussion points, and then these blank pages.
So, and this was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, mm-hmm. was there a point at which you made this decision, the choice of making it more of a how-to book than the story of your life and the things that you did. So was there a point where you made that conscious decision, or was that kind of from the beginning?
Well, I wanted it to be a little bit of everything, part story, but also, something that I didn't want to just wow people, or I didn't want it to just be some sort of interesting story. Oh, there's a guy living in a 10x7 house, and then, they read the book and then they go on with their life and nothing changes. So I wanted there to be some way to have people connect with what I'd experienced in a relevant and meaningful way and then start to apply those things to their own life, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily that everybody's going to move, from 2,000 square feet down to 140. For me, I see, living the extreme is a way of inspiring others to shift, just to shift, maybe to go from 1,500 to 1,000 or 1,000 to 500, just to shift in a certain direction of simplicity and sustainability.
In fact, that is something you talk in the book a lot about, is how to make the transition, that it's not about all or nothing, that you're either living this way or you're not, that there's ways to transition.
Right.
Step by step,
because otherwise it's just like, on page one, I describe I'm living in 2,000 square feet, and then suddenly I'm describing I'm living in 140, and people are like, whoa, how did that happen?
Right.
It's like a magic trick.
Right.
So I wanted to just give them the details of how I went through that. And then for each chapter then, I have, these action points. So it really causes people to stop for a moment. Don't go on to the next chapter. Think about what can you do in your life? What's practical steps can you take that'll bring about change in your life that'll be a positive thing for you? And then discussion points for people to discuss with their partner or with friends or whatever. And then these blank pages, maybe people will use them as note pages, that would be nice. Even if they don't, it's more like a message of saying, open up your mind. This is time for you to...
Well, it worked on me because I made a lot of those changes already, but it forced me to say, okay, well, what else can I do? And I looked across the room and saw my full-size refrigerator that's empty most of the time, mm-hmm. and I instantly went online and started to look for smaller, more efficient,
cool.
energy-efficient refrigerators. So pretty soon here, I'll be getting one of those. And one of the interesting things is you might expect from the book is that you're going to be talking about the living situation, but you really go into all the different areas of a person's life, mm-hmm. looking at all of those. Why don't you talk about the different areas?
Okay.
We've talked a little bit about transportation. In fact, I wanted to ask you, one of the coolest things, the thing that got my attention, you tell the story about your dad when you were younger, and he said it takes less time to ride your bicycle from Iowa City to Des Moines than it does to drive a car. And of course, a person's first response is going to be, well, that's ludicrous.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell that story? I like that story.
Okay. My dad was always good at, bringing up these stories and ways of looking at life that you might not normally stumble into. And this was one of them where he was describing that the bicycle was faster than a car. And I just thought, how can a bicycle be faster than a car? But then he explained that, the car, you have to make your car payments. You have to buy the car. So it takes time to earn the money to pay for the car, whereas it takes a lot less time to earn the money to buy a bike. Maybe you can get one for free. So if you, let's say, you get a bicycle for $100, but the car costs $15,000, if two people start at the same time and the one person has to earn $15,000 before they can drive the first mile,
right.
You know, it's going to take that person a year to get to Des Moines, maybe, or maybe 6 months or maybe 3 months, depending on their income, you know. So,
and even if you look at the actual cost of operating a vehicle, there's going to be costs even beyond once you have the vehicle, you've already got it.
Yeah.
But then if you looked at it, if you broke it down by the cost of operating a car versus a bicycle,
mm-hmm.
you'd have to do the same analysis. So on the topic of your father, you mentioned in the acknowledgments of your book that he was one of the books that he wrote was an inspiration. So why don't you talk a little bit about your father, his background, and how he came to inspire you.
Yeah, I guess he's done many things, and people that want to learn more can visit his website, nicholasjohnson.org. Some of the highlights that I remember that inspired me were in the 1970s, in the late 60s, early 70s, he was FCC commissioner and worked to get tobacco ads off of television because we used to advertise
right.
cigarettes to
I
little kids.
That.
And he thought maybe that wasn't good. And so there was this long battle, of course, the tobacco industry thought it was good to advertise to little kids. And so eventually, though, he went out. And so that then was one of many examples that I remember seeing that, you know, citizens, regular citizens, need to get involved in consumer advocacy issues and public issues, that we need to get involved in the process because, you know, left unchecked, you know, a company, whatever they're selling, if it's good, that's great. If it's not good, then there's a problem. And that, you know, they're rewarded. The more cigarettes they sell, the more money they make. So there's no incentive to, like, stop selling cigarettes. Anyway, I was inspired by that example. And in growing up, he was working with Ralph Nader at the time on some campaign finance reform types of issues and environmental issues and consumer issues. So I had that kind of context and background of being aware of public interest work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 70s, my dad wrote this book called Test Pattern for Living. And the book had a lot of ideas in it about, you know, riding a bike to work and about eating healthy foods and exercise and how to live, really. And I didn't have it in mind at the beginning of as I was writing my book. I was just writing my book.
Right.
But then in sort of partway through it, I thought, oh, this is kind of like what my dad did. He wrote this book on, you know, ideas, thoughts about living mindfully and thoughtfully, you know.
So is your dad still writing, and what's he doing?
Yeah, he's in Iowa City teaching at the University of Iowa College of Law. Still involved in doing lots of writing through his blog, which you can get to from his website, nicholasjohnson.org, or if you want to go directly, it's from DC to the number 2, iowa.blogspot.com. But he has regular...
Yeah, and if you just search for Nicholas Johnson, he comes up.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what... Was becoming a writer something you were interested in at a young age, or was it just something you fell into?
I never thought of myself as a writer or somebody who would go on to write books, but I know I've always loved writing. And ever since word processing became available in the late 70s, Radio Shack had something called the Model 1 computer, and there was a word processing program called Scriptsit. And that I think was when I fell in love with writing. I just thought it was so cool that you could, you know, that the words could be like clay and you could just kind of move them around, you know, and pick a paragraph up and move it and copy and paste and delete. And so it really made, for me, it made writing, word processing was really like one of the first video games for me, you know, before we have other video games now. So I kind of fell in love with writing and word processing as though it, with the same kind of passion that kids today want to play video games. But then over time, I've had, as you'll see from the website, resourcesforlife.com, there's a newsletter that's been going out now for quite some time that I send out once a month, and I write about a variety of topics that could be, you know, politics or health or religion, spirituality, all kinds of things. And it's through those monthly newsletters over the past 8 years or so that I've honed my writing skills. And So a book makes sense. The only book that I'd given some thought to, which I think I still may want to pursue creating, is like a little reference guide that people could carry around. Uh-huh. And it would have documents in there that were sort of, my thought was to include some of my own original writing that I would put into the Creative Commons for people to have and use, and then draw from some other writings that are available, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, United mm-hmm. Nations document, and maybe the Constitution, and you know, some different charts for converting from Celsius to Fahrenheit or whatever. Just like, what would be the ultimate little pocket guide that would have all this stuff in there?
So when you were writing, did you have a particular routine that you worked on, and did you have a goal in terms of when you did the publisher have a kind of a time when they wanted to get this all published, get it all done? And it,
yeah, we had sort of a timeline that we were working on, and it helped to have them coaxing me along because you know, the writing process can slow down. And it was really fun. I have had an opportunity to take some writing courses at the University of Iowa that are, I guess, in part connected to or influenced by the Writer's Workshop. And so those were wonderful experiences, to be writing and having other people critique my writing and challenge me in my writing. And, you know, writing this book was very much like that experience. It was like being part of the Writer's Workshop, in the sense that, you know, you have people really going over your writing with a fine-tooth comb, and, and people who are really skilled. So they're coming up with good questions and good challenges, and I think it helps to hone the final product.
So there were multiple people at the editor, at the publisher that was that were reviewing your work?
Yeah, a number of people were looking over it. I mean, there was a primary editor who was reviewing it, and we would go back and forth. But then, you know, she would engage other editors. I think there were maybe three or four people looking it over. So it was,
did that come as a surprise to you?
Yeah, kind of. I thought, oh, I'm going to write this book, and then they're just going to print it. But no, it was really like, you know, they were challenging me. It's like, you know.
Yeah, I was at a writer's workshop where a woman who's had like 500 children's book published, and she was talking about that process, and that's one of the key steps as a writer, is to be able to get past the ego, which is saying, oh, it's perfect, but and recognize it needs to be improved, and that other people's opinions are going to make it a better work.
Yeah, there were entire chapters I just deleted, like whole chapters or things that I'd write. And, you know, at some point, you fall so much in love with the process of writing that you just don't care. It's like, you know, it's like you're playing basketball. It doesn't really matter who has the ball. It's just like, hey, this is fun. You
right.
Know?
So the you're focusing on the process instead of the end result. And
yeah. I mean, initially there's some sense of ownership of it, but really, you know, my mind is very much in the thinking of cooperative works and collective ownership. And so, you know, I see very much that it was a collective cooperative creation.
And how did you decide on the title?
Oh, there again, right in line with this subject, is in talking with Gibbs Smith, the publisher, and some others, we came up with about 10 titles that I really liked, and I can't even remember what they are now. But this one was from totally out of left field. I didn't even think up the title. This was something that they came up with. And so, but fine, you know, I was like, that's good. You know, the writing is mine from cover to cover, but the front and the back cover, there was a quote on there, something about live simply. See, I should have this memorized, but it's, be kind to the planet, be gentle on your wallet, and rejuvenate your life. So, you know, a lot of this book is really about what they were able to do to take the writing and package it. I mean, I'm just opening up here to page 20. There's a table describing how our life reflects our priorities. So that table, they created that, you know. Anywhere in the book where you see quotes pulled out and made into bold, they've done that. Any of the boxes, you know, all that stuff that really makes it pop out, you know, the layout and the design of it, they did all of that. The writing process that I went through was all with basically raw text. I mean, there wasn't even like italics or underlining. So that was kind of new for me. I'm used to being the person who chooses the fonts and who chooses the colors and, you know, but I totally let go. And part of the reason also was, the title of the book didn't come up until the very end, until the book was completely written. Because we didn't, I mean, what do you call it until it is it? What is it?
Right.
You know, we didn't know what it was going to be. So I wanted to be like, from the publisher's standpoint, the best writer they could have. You know, I thought maybe if I'm really cooperative, they'll ask me to write another book. So I was like, yeah, whatever title you want to give it.
So we're talking to Gregory Paul Johnson, author of Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. And I'm Steve Cooperman, guest hosting for Writers' Voices on KRUU LP 100.1 FM. Let's see, what other questions should I ask you? How have you been involved in promoting the book?
Well, I would think that book promotion would be kind of a challenge for people unless they have a promoter or unless they're already, you know, part of some talk show circuit or something. I mean, if you're a writer and you come up with a book, how do you... You tell your friends, you tell your family.
So, but, and how active is Gibbs Smith?
Very active. I mean, they sent out a press release to, it was an amazing list of like all the top media outlets and everything. They got the book into Barnes & Noble on the shelves. The book, it turns out, has been, there's a retailer in Iowa City that they took the book, well, actually it's Vortex Gifts, you know. Vortex Gifts in Iowa City has the book. It's one of the top 10 selling books since, like, in the history of their store. So it's because of, I think, this extra promotion that's gone on with Gibbs Smith. They, as I say, got it into Barnes & Noble. So once it's on the bookshelves and people see it, well, that's a big help, you know.
Right.
I mean, for anybody's book, you know.
Right.
And then there was already this undercurrent of the small house movement. So, you know, it's like the book was written to an audience that was already there waiting to read this book. So I didn't have to, like, create, what do they call it, manufacturing the
demand.
Need or
yeah.
You know, demand. I mean, the demand was there.
Right. So, and what words of advice would you have for someone who is interested in writing a book in terms of either looking for or working with a publisher?
There have been times when I've thought about, and I've recommended, you know, Lulu.com to be just publishing on demand. And if you just need someone to print a book, you know, it's one way to go, and they can get you onto Amazon and assign an ISBN number and all that. But the nice thing about having a publisher is they really can help from a professional standpoint with the whole sense of aesthetics and how to promote the book and how to really get it out there. So I think people have asked me, you know, how do you create an effective website? And if a person's trying to create an effective website, and then that's all they think about is how do I promote my website, then it's like this sort of self-referring circle. If you type in small house, I'll just do that right now, on Google, there are 89 million results, and the top link is the Small House Society. And there are a number of other topics where you can just type in that those words and the resourcesforlife.com website will come up as number one. So I've had people say, how do you get those kind of rankings? I mean, who do you pay? What are you doing? And I said, you know, actually, I'm not doing anything. You know, I don't focus on promoting my site. I focus on the content of my site. I could be spending hours and hours and hours trying to figure out search engines and pay people to do, you know, all this stuff. It's like, no, I'm just going to focus on content, and then organically it will rise to the top because I've spent all my time and energy on the quality, the content. There's a funny Apple computer commercial right now where they show the guy, you know, he's saying, you know, we're putting this much money into advertising and this much money into improving Vista, you know. It's just like hardly anything goes to improving Vista, everything goes to advertising. You know, so the bottom line is they haven't improved their product. So similarly with the website, I'm just going to improve the product. I mean, if it's good, it'll market itself. Same thing's true for a book. I think, you know, become part of the movement that you're writing about. If it's organic gardening, then, you know, have your organic garden, start a local club, go speak to, even if you don't get paid an honorarium, you know, go speak at colleges, go to events, have tables. I mean, you become the gardening, organic gardening expert, then you come out with a book. So you don't have to, like, you know, hype it. And then even the book, I mean, the book itself, you just invest all your energy into the quality of making it a unique book. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'd like to see in books are these, you know, the action points. I think whatever the book's on, if it's on health, if it's on relationships, if it's on, you know, housing, organic gardening, whatever, you know, I don't want to just get to the end of the chapter and then be like, oh, well, now what? You know, I'd like to have some sort of ideas to prod me along and then some discussion points.
So as you were going through writing the book, did that, any of those prod you into taking action? By the process of having...
Yeah, exactly. In some ways, you know, you start exploring your passion about something exceeds your actual lifestyle, you know. So I was like, oh, I should do this.
And how has having the book published changed your life?
Oh, it's really been wonderful. You know, I've ended up giving away a lot of copies of the book. I mean, for me, it's something that, it's a message I would want to get out there anyway. So it's just, I guess, added benefit that I'm, you know, getting paid to get the message out. But it's a really good feeling. It's a sense of responsibility too. I mean, like, as I mentioned with the website, to be right up there with Wikipedia and even, you know, my site sometimes is ranked above MSN or above Yahoo. You know, there's this sense of responsibility when you have a book published, when you have a very a website with high exposure, when you are able to get on the radio, or I've been on National Public Radio and on PBS a couple of times, or you know, local Iowa Public Television. Anyway, so you kind of it gets you to the point where you it humbles you a little bit. And it makes you realize, okay, I need to use this reach and this impact in a real positive way, you know, sense of responsibility.
Yeah, so how do you see both the book and the choices in your own life having impact beyond your own life?
Oh, it's amazing because it's like that movie Pay It Forward. You know, mm-hmm. there's this kid who helps three people who help three people and suddenly, like, you know, the world's transformed. But yeah, if... I've been involved for decades in, you know, social activism, and mm-hmm. and I've carried, you know, picket signs and protested or whatever, you know, different causes and issues. And but finally I realized, you know, it's so much more effective just to live the answer, you know, rather than seeking out what's wrong in the world and complaining about it. Just find out what's right in the world, you know, find out what works and just do it. Uh-huh. And people will copy that, you know, mm-hmm. and pretty soon you'll have... I mean, the small house movement went from, if you did a Google search, I said now it's up to, you know, 80-some million. 5 years ago, if you did a Google search on small house, it's like searching for small elephant. They're really small house. What's that?
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
And so now the website gets thousands of visitors every week from 90 different countries. You know, it's a real movement. So in anything, if we live the answer, our actions are the loudest words we can speak, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what really the book is about, is sharing this message of living the answer.
So there's tons of resources on your website, Resources for Life. Are there any other resources that you'd recommend for people who are either interested in building a small home or any of these other issues around living more simply?
Yeah, you know, Shay Solomon's book, The Small House... let me just...
Yeah, actually, brought it. This is a great book, Little House on a Small Planet. I don't remember where I bought this, but...
She and Nigel traveled, you know, the country interviewing people, real life, you know, real practical examples.
This is a fun book because you get to see these different ideas, different ways people have applied the principles and all the creativity that goes into to setting up the
And how they made the relationships work. We didn't get into that, but there really is a whole discussion about how do two people make... small living work, and how can, you know, you really have to have two minimalists to make it happen. You can't have one person who wants a big space and one person who wants a small space. But so I would say littlehouseonasmallplanet.com is their website. Jay Schaefer, tumbleweedhouses.com is a good resource. But, you know, certainly the Small House Society, you just go to smallhousesociety.org and that will link you out to all kinds of blogs. And the resourcesforlife.com website is pretty much self-financed, so we're not asking for money. Mm-hmm. There's no advertising, so it's kind of like PBS, but you don't have to, or National Public Radio, but they don't have one of those days where they're asking for money. You know, it's just like basically, for the most part, an advertising-free website. There are some sponsors, but the content is really 95% of what you see on the site.
So you're generating most of your income at this point from your consulting or what?
Yeah, just through consulting. I'm my number one donor, you know. Yeah. And then there's some sales that take place through the website, but in an unobtrusive way. I have advertising, what I call quarantined, because I feel like advertising can kind of get out of control, like cuts through. So there's a, you know, if you want to go shopping, there's a page where you can go shopping.
You quarantine the shopping set.
Yeah, so, quarantine retail. And I've actually been able to reduce my sales in recent years by, I have this disclaimer, and I encourage people not to buy. Please don't shop at my store. You shouldn't be shopping. Isn't there something you could buy used? Yeah. Have you thought about buying locally? You know.
Well, that's an interesting, because that was one of the questions I had was, you chose to print this book as opposed to have it available as a download or something like that. Was there ever a conversation about that? I noticed your dad's book is available for download.
Yeah, that's interesting. As I say, I just kind of went with the flow of what the publisher wanted to do. I'm really very much into web-based information that can be dynamic and change and such. So, you know, in the process of writing the book, I thought, wow, I need to do this in a way that it becomes more like a reference guide. So it's not just like another consumable good, you know, like a novel that you'll read and then toss away or something.
Yeah, so you mentioned creating some kind of resource guide. Do you have any other plans for or ideas for writing other books?
Yeah, I think I really do want to create, as I was saying, something through, you know, anything Gibbs Smith would want me to write again, I'd be happy to do. Or, you know, maybe something that doesn't have the market value but has, I think, social value, which would be like a small guide with information and resources about, you know, living on this planet in the age that we're living in. Things about health, finance, relationships, basically resourcesforlife.com in a book.
Yeah, great. Well, before we finish up here, I'm just going to mention a few points unrelated to this interview. You should stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore coming up from 2 to 5 p.m. if you're listening to us on Friday. If you're listening on Monday morning, stay tuned for the Cult Show. Monica generally mentions a few activities that are going on coming up. We've got two somewhat writer-related. We've got a Lion in Winter at MUM Spade Theater tonight, Saturday and Sunday, as well as Friday through Sunday, December 5th through 7th. We also have singer-songwriter Ellis Saturday night, November 29th at Cafe Paradiso. Let's see, what else am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to read a quote. I guess that's how I finish. We've got a few minutes here. Is there any closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
I guess I should have said, you know, made the invitation open. If anybody has questions about, you know, simplifying their life, any questions about the book, if you've read it, or just anything I can help with, feel free to write me. You can contact me through the website, resourcesforlife.com, and you'll see there my email address is just G, the letter G, at resourcesforlife.com, and I also have a phone number listed. So I'm happy to take you know, calls from people as they have questions.
Well, thanks very much, Greg, for coming down from Iowa City today. Oh, I forgot to ask you, how'd you get down here?
I got a ride from somebody.
Oh, you got a ride from somebody.
You know, 95% of my transportation is bicycle, and when I need to go further than my bike can take me, I'll either, you know, rent a car or borrow a car and pay, you know, 50 cents a mile or something when I use one. So
great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming down. This show will be rebroadcast on Monday at 8 a.m., and you can listen also online or check the archives for past shows of Writers' Voices. And so to close with a quote, this is a quote from Greg's book from Thoreau. As you simplify your life, the laws of the universe will be simpler. Solitude will not be solitude. Poverty will not be poverty, nor weakness, weakness.